that experience of becoming a refugee and packing into cities such as Richmond, together with inflation, brought a series of bread riots in the Confederacy in 1863. There was a shortage of bread, money wouldn't go far enough, and many women took to the streets. Most famously in Richmond in early April 1863, they rampaged through town, shattering windows, stealing food, eventually being confronted by Jefferson Davis, who tried to placate them. He offered all the money he had. Other politicians did as well. When they still seemed intent, the women, on continuing their rioting, Jefferson Davis said he would order the military to fire on them if they didn't disperse. And in the end, they did. The war extracted a far higher toll on Confederate than on Northern families in a couple of obvious ways. Talked about the high casualty rates among Confederate men. A quarter of the military-age white men killed, another quarter maimed. One of the practical results on that was that families were more perilously situated in the Confederacy than in the North. By 1870, there were 25,000 more women than men in North Carolina, 36,000 more women than men in Georgia, 15,000 in Virginia, 8,000 in South Carolina. Many of these women were presiding as heads of family, looking after farms, trying to rear families pretty much on their own. By 1890, 60,000 Confederate widows remained unmarried. And current research shows that the Confederacy did not have as dramatic a permanent change in work and other values as you found in the North, but in this sense, in having thousands of women who became widows and never remarried, thousands of women who remained as heads of households, there was a significant change that the war wrought in the lives of these Southerners, of these white Southerners. Patterns of work and patterns of authority were changed because of this in the post-war South. Let's turn just briefly to the experience of free black women and slave women in the Confederacy. Now, we've already touched on much of the experience of black women who would make their way to Union lines, the contraband experience. We've talked about that and the great changes that would bring, contraband camps being very difficult places, these people taking a great risk to make their way to freedom. We've also talked about how the bonds of slavery loosened in the course of the war, how white masters could not exert quite the level of control over their slaves as they had exerted before the Civil War. In the end, of course, slave women were huge winners in the war because they were freed from their bondage, and the war created a number of changes that went beyond the fact of being emancipated. Some of these changes would have very long-term consequences, others shorter-term consequences. But some of the things that it did, the war and the bringing of emancipation, was to make possible true families, real marriages, legal marriages for slave women. There had been marriages, sort of common law marriages, if you like, functional marriages, but not marriages that were recognized by law before the war. Now there could be families, families with the kinds of legal bonds that white families would have. Many slave women tried to set up their own ideal of what a woman should do after the war, what kinds of work were proper for women. They tried to set up a sort of version of the domestic household that was the ideal in the North. They didn't want to do field work anymore. Women should not be in the field. They should be nurturing. They should be setting up the kind of household that the North had held up as an ideal, and the South too, for white women before the war. This was an opportunity for them to try to get away from the slave conventions of just utter drudgery, working in the field, back-breaking labor from sunup to sundown. Some scholars have tried to preach a sort of sisterhood between white slaveholding women and slave women, to say that the most important bond was a gender bond, that they were all women first and that the other things came secondarily. And they'll quote these scholars, they'll quote Mary Chestnut, for example, saying that she believed slavery was a monstrous institution.